Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Centre here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan US Centre's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. Nuclear weapons have been an important part of the United States defence policy for over 70 years. In response to what the US sees as potential growing threats from China and North Korea, nuclear weapons are becoming a more and more important part of US alliance commitments and partnerships in East Asia, with countries like South Korea, the Philippines, and Japan. But what does this focus on nuclear weapons for both deterrence and reassurance mean for US foreign policy, and for the security of the region? And could there be an alternative which puts a greater focus on conventional armed forces? To discuss these topics, in June 2025, I spoke to Lauren Sukin, Assistant Professor in LSE's Department of International Relations, and a center affiliate at the LSE Phelan US Center. Dr. Sukin's research examines issues of international security, focusing particularly on nuclear weapons and alliance politics. We spoke about her recent article in the Journal for Peace and Nuclear Disarmament with Samuel Seitz of MIT, De-emphasizing Nuclear Weapons and Nuclear Deterrence, the Case for Conventional Counterforce. I began our conversation by asking Dr. Sukin to give an overview of the article and its main arguments.
So what we're trying to do in this article is think about how to deter the use of nuclear weapons. A lot of the literature on this question makes the pretty traditional argument that you can only deter nuclear weapons with the threat of nuclear use. But this isn't really what we see states investing in today, especially in the East Asia context. We've seen these bigger investments in what we might call conventional counterforce capabilities, precision strike systems, and more powerful conventional weapons that are able to target some of the assets that are essential to nuclear infrastructure. The puzzle here is, why would you buy these conventional systems if we think we can really only stop nuclear conflict with nuclear assets? And so what we argue is that these conventional systems are an increasingly important part of nuclear deterrence, and that investing in building them, but also the interoperability between allies and partners that are using these systems, can really enhance nuclear deterrence. And in many ways, help us avoid some of the pitfalls of nuclear strategies that over-rely on nuclear weapons to accomplish these multiple nuclear-related missions in a region.
And I think it might be helpful. You mentioned it sort of briefly. This idea of nuclear deterrence, maybe you could just talk a little bit about what nuclear deterrence is and give a brief history of that term and its use, especially as a lot of people might be familiar with it in terms of its Cold War context.
So nuclear deterrence is about, how do you prevent a state from using nuclear weapons? And we usually think of this in terms of what we might call mutually assured destruction, or MAD. And this is a Cold War term, and it suggests that the reason why we don't see states use their nuclear weapons is because they know that if they did that, they would be hit back hard with the same types of capabilities at this massive level of destruction. So in order for mutually assured destruction, for nuclear deterrence in this conventional sense to work, what you have to worry about is that after you hit with that first nuclear strike, the other side not only can survive that, but that their nuclear weapons remain competent, their systems are still online, and they can strike back and hit you. And the result of this is that nuclear strategy has often prioritized what we call survivability, the ability to take that first hit and then still return a strike. Mutually assured destruction, or nuclear deterrence, gives us this idea that really rational states, rational actors, are too scared of the costs of nuclear escalation to use those weapons. What we're trying to argue is that there are lots of things that are pretty scary in this world. It's not just nuclear strikes, and that actually we see that states are really worried about large-scale conventional war as well as nuclear retaliation. So if we think about maybe the Russo-Ukrainian war, we might ask the question, why hasn't Russia used nuclear weapons? And this traditional answer would tell us they haven't used nuclear weapons because NATO has nuclear weapons, and they're afraid that if they use their nuclear weapons, NATO will retaliate with its nuclear asset. But I don't think that really captures the dynamic of what's going on. The Biden administration were pretty clear that nuclear retaliation would not be their first recourse if Russia were in a limited way to use nuclear assets. And actually, it seems that the reason why Russia has refrained from using its nuclear systems is because they're worried about an expanded conventional war. And of course, as conventional systems have become more and more sophisticated, the costs of a large-scale conventional war have also become so much bigger, to the point that that in and of itself could be enough to prevent even competent, capable nuclear states from using those powerful assets.
So much of your paper focuses on China and U.S. nuclear guarantees in Asia. What role have nuclear weapons historically played in America's Asian alliance system?
Unlike the U.S. alliance system in NATO, America's alliances and partnerships in Asia have taken a much more dispersed form. The U.S. has generally relied on bilateral alliances and small mini-lateral partnerships between countries who sometimes cooperate and sometimes compete. In many of these alliances, nuclear weapons have been a focus. They're not the only element of power and influence in U.S. alliances, both throughout the Cold War and today. But the U.S. engages in nuclear cooperation with many of its allies in the region, meaning that either it collaborates with them on nuclear energy issues or planning for nuclear threats. And during the Cold War, the U.S. actually had its nuclear weapons or some of its nuclear weapons stationed throughout the region as a way to try to reassure countries that the U.S. was willing and able to engage in nuclear contestation with nuclear-armed China or with the Soviet Union if conflicts in the region got to that point. One of the things we argue in the paper is that nuclear weapons have been an important component of these alliances and partnerships throughout the history of the U.S. role in East Asia, but that the centering of nuclear weapons, both in the Cold War and today, has created numerous problems, both with allies and adversaries, that perhaps would be resolved or less severe if the U.S. were to prioritize conventional cooperation in a future Asian alliance system.
So one thing you talk about in your paper is the differing view between China and the U.S. of nuclear use. And in China's case, you talk about them having a binary view of nuclear use, in contrast with what you call the U.S.'s escalation spectrum. What are these differing strategies, and how might these different ways of thinking about nuclear use lead to the greater risk of the use of nuclear weapons?
In the nuclear literature more generally, there are lots of different theories of how nuclear war would work or what would play out if one country used nuclear weapons. The way that most scholarship and most policymaking in the U.S. now tends to think about this question is to view escalation as an escalation ladder. There are smaller sub-nuclear steps that you could take that might slowly lead up to nuclear use, and then you can use, you know, a small number of nuclear weapons or a large number of nuclear weapons, low-yield weapons or high-yield weapons, in a series of escalating steps all the way up to catastrophic nuclear war. And although there's some disagreement here, many strategists in the U.S. have argued that you can take a step onto that ladder. You can use one nuclear weapon in a limited way without everything spiraling out of control. The dominant view in Chinese thinking on nuclear weapons doesn't really make quite as much of a distinction between these different steps, and also tends not to think that escalation can be limited. That is, we characterize China's view of how nuclear war would play out as much more binary. You either don't use nuclear weapons, or you're in a state of all-out nuclear war. That is, Chinese thinkers on nuclear policy don't really seem to think that you can keep nuclear war limited. Now, that's a concern. If one side thinks a small, more limited use of nuclear weapons is bound to escalate into a much larger conflagration, then in those initial stages of a nuclear conflict, they should be much more aggressive because they're anticipating that we're moving all the way down to the end of the line. That fear of limited nuclear use might mean that China makes different decisions in a crisis situation than the United States would, because they might think that the options are far more limited. These are different views have persisted throughout history. So there have been moments in time where the U.S. thought that nuclear war was much more capable of being limited or not capable of being limited. Soviet and Russian scholarship has also held different views about how nuclear use might work. But where we really start to see dangers is when two adversaries don't agree on how nuclear war might play out, because their risk calculations are then going to be quite different.
In your paper, you say that inflexibility in arms control means that if the US is to slow down China's nuclear expansion, it must model this behavior itself. Is this likely?
One of the big challenges today in the nuclear world is the movement away from nuclear arms control. Part of this has to do with Russia and the US backing away from some of their arms control commitments in the wake of the Russo-Ukrainian war. But it also has to do with the growing complications in the nuclear landscape. In particular, China's buildup of its nuclear forces poses a new nuclear world for the US, where it has two increasingly powerful nuclear adversaries and has to be able to deter both of them at the same time. It has to be able to deal with the possibility of concurrent crises in multiple regions that could all have a nuclear component. As a result of this environment, one of the things that the United States very much would like to do is to engage in either trilateral arms control with both China and Russia, or bilateral arms control with China, to try to slow down China's nuclear expansion. If the US could have its way, this would mean caps on the numbers of nuclear weapons or nuclear delivery vehicles that China could develop. But from China's perspective, that's not a great compromise. China wants to be able to engage with US nuclear capabilities in the Asia-Pacific region. To do that, it may need a more sophisticated military. And what you end up with is this potential arms racing spiral, where China is trying to match US capabilities. The US now believes it has these two nuclear adversaries and it needs to modernize its capabilities. As the US modernizes, China is facing this moving goalpost for how much it has to modernize. And there are other challenges as well, with things having to do with differing approaches to arms control and the lack of diplomatic engagement on arms control with China, that make this a really intractable problem. So one of the things that we note in the paper is that the US has a choice. It can prioritize this arms control route, or it can try to enhance its deterrent capabilities with China. And if the US chooses the track of trying to enhance its deterrence capabilities, and it does that by building new nuclear systems, either new nuclear weapons or new nuclear delivery systems, we think it's very likely that China will only try to mirror those developments by continuing to invest in its own capabilities. The question you asked, though, wasn't why this dynamic is happening, but is it likely that we can get out of the spiral? And here, you're asking me to make a political prediction about the administration, something that I think is quite difficult to do in today's environment. I'm not sure that it's likely that the US decides to prioritize arms control, but of course, President Trump has shown continuous interest in nuclear arms control since before his first administration, and has made some overtures about willingness to engage in talks. So it is possible that this is an outcome for the administration, but at the same time, I think it's not the most likely outcome.
In your paper, you also talk about what you call the impossible Goldilocks problem of nuclear security guarantees. Can you talk about what this means to the US?
The US has these alliances and partnerships in the region, as I said, and many of them have nuclear security guarantees or nuclear security assurances. And the way a nuclear security guarantee works is that the US tells an ally, you don't need to build your own nuclear weapons, because if you face a nuclear threat, we promise to protect you. And not only do we promise to protect you, but if that protection requires the use of US nuclear weapons, we're willing to do that. So the US has a nuclear security guarantee with, for example, South Korea. If there were a nuclear conflict with North Korea, the US promises that it will step in to try to resolve that situation and might even use its nuclear weapons to do that. Now, the problem here is that for that guarantee to work, South Korea has to believe that the United States is willing to use nuclear weapons. And if the US is willing to use nuclear weapons, then it also has to believe that the US is not so willing to use nuclear weapons that it might do so preemptively or in a situation that would not really be beneficial to South Korean interests. It's a very fine line. You have to promise that you'll protect someone, but not that you'll go ham in order to do so. This is a communication challenge that the US has had throughout the Cold War, and one that's become increasingly complicated today. How do you signal commitment, but also signal restraint at the same time? One of the solutions that we offer in the paper is to prioritize conventional ways of deterrence, because then you're able to demonstrate that you're willing to get into this fight, but that the fight doesn't necessarily have to be a nuclear war. And so by lowering some of the tension, some of the costs of a potential conflict, then you might be able to not only demonstrate a higher degree of willingness to engage if tensions really start to spiral, but also you might be able to demonstrate some degree of a willingness to use restraint even in a crisis or a conflict.
So your article calls for conventional counterforce as an alternative to nuclear deterrence. Can you talk about how this works in practice and what makes it strategically and politically possible?
So the vision that we articulate for conventional counterforce in the region would involve conventional assets and a number of U.S. allies and partners, as well as American conventional assets in the region. And so we're encouraging the U.S. to work with its partners like South Korea and Japan, who are already interested in these systems and things like precision strike capabilities, or with the new AUKUS deal to work with Australia to develop these longer range submarines that could play more of a role in a potential conflict with China. So to build out those systems among U.S. allies and partners in the region, but to do so in a way that is collaborative and has an eye towards how these multiple partner militaries might work together if there would be some larger conflict. There are lots of ways to do this. And one of the things that the U.S. already does today is to run joint military exercises with its partners in the region. These military exercises, we argue, could be used as a way to plan and to practice using conventional assets in the event of a nuclear adjacent threat. We also argue that the U.S. could engage more explicitly in planning for nuclear threats and communication with its allies about what sorts of options might be on the table, what role allies and partners might play if there were to be a nuclear crisis that breaks out in the region. What we're essentially building on is this idea of integrated deterrence, of nuclear weapons being part of a broader suite of military assets, rather than something that gets siloed off into a corner where nuclear weapons play this nuclear role, and we don't think about how they might integrate with other capabilities and with other partners.
Many U.S. policymakers and global allies have implicitly argued that only nuclear weapons really deter nuclear weapons. How do you respond to that logic in your argument for potentially reducing the number of nuclear weapons?
Well, first I'll say we're not arguing necessarily for reducing the number of nuclear weapons, but for decentering nuclear weapons in some of our strategy. And importantly, what we argue is that these conventional assets need to be backed up by what we might call an existential deterrent. That is, the U.S. can still say we have nuclear weapons, they are survivable, and if a conflict were to spiral out of control or an adversary were to use nuclear weapons at a large scale, then the U.S. would have this capability to protect itself and to protect its allies. But there are many, many steps that we could take in a conflict before we get to that kind of escalation. And what we're trying to argue is that we don't need to plan as much for these limited uses of nuclear weapons that we think are more likely to spiral in this particular context because of the way China thinks about nuclear strategy and the way that North Korea thinks about nuclear strategy. So, for example, if we saw a demonstration use of nuclear weapons to try to scare the U.S. off from defending Taiwan, we might argue the U.S. should not respond to that with nuclear assets, but has a vast portfolio of conventional tools at its disposal that it could use to signal its strength and to convey that it actually is willing to fight, that it has the alliance network and the power that it can bring to bear in the region, without having to default to nuclear weapons simply because a conflict begins to look like a nuclear crisis. And this way, we think that conventional assets can be part of a broader approach to deterring nuclear weapons And that when we think about nuclear deterrence, we should not be thinking only about deterring with nuclear weapons, but deterring the use of nuclear weapons. And that there are many ways to do the latter that don't necessarily require as much of or as immediate of a threat to use nuclear weapons.
Thinking about the conventional counterforce discussion we've had, does that imply a larger conventional force or a bigger buildup for the US of what they already have? From what you've said, I think it implies a force that might deter the use of nuclear weapons, or at least make some other power think twice about using them. So are you talking about using existing resources, existing assets, large increase of forces, or their strength?
We're not necessarily talking about greater numbers of forces. The US has a large number of military personnel in East Asia already, but it might require additional capabilities, so perhaps improved investments in precision strike capabilities, enhanced deployments of certain types of weapons or delivery systems, of modernization to the Navy capabilities that are in the region. But many of these types of developments are already underway in the United States and in its allies and partners. And part of what we emphasize in the paper is not even the need for new systems, but the need for greater cooperation so that the systems that each of the US allies and partners in the region develop are developed in coordination with the US and have the accompanying planning and exercising so that they can be used in a comprehensive strategy that doesn't involve the US acting alone, but acting in concert with its allies and partners. There are lots of elements of modernization here that we might consider. So one of the questions for the US is how to continue to develop the technological capabilities of their forces and how to best fight in an emerging technological environment. And again, these are conversations that are already underway in the United States and that we think should be not siloed away from the nuclear discussion, but that instead, when the US is thinking about what military modernization would look like, it's thinking about how these assets might be able to be used to target key bases in key infrastructure in China or North Korea, the degree to which those assets might be hardened, and what sorts of systems would be necessary if a crisis were really to start to spiral out of control.
In the recent conflict between Iran and Israel, we've seen the use of conventional forces and the potential for what some have termed an escalation spiral. How does your paper and your work really speak to this unfolding conflict and maybe even thinking about the US's involvement now?
So what we've seen in the Iran-Israel conflict is what we might call a counter-proliferation strategy, where certainly Israel and potentially some elements in the US believe that Iran was close to acquiring a nuclear weapon and had the intention to acquire a nuclear weapon. And so the strikes were intended to slow down or end or reverse the Iranian nuclear program. In this context, unfortunately, I think what we're seeing is a lesson that's quite dangerous, not only for Iran, but for other actors around the world who might conclude that if only Iran had had a nuclear weapon rather than this nuclear latency capability, that these strikes wouldn't have happened. I think it underscores the power of nuclear deterrence, especially for states that face significant threats from capable and even nuclear powers like the United States. And unfortunately, I think one of the things that we have learned from the literature on nuclear counterproliferation is that these strikes are unlikely to prevent nuclear proliferation efforts in the future. If anything, they often encourage regimes to invest more heavily in their nuclear architecture, to try to adopt a strategy of racing towards the bomb, doing so in a way that is fast and hidden, less detectable, because the value of nuclear weapons only is underscored when we see these types of attacks happening. Our articulation of conventional counterforce really only works with existential deterrence, with nuclear deterrence as a backup. We don't argue in this paper that conventional weapons can deter nuclear powers point blank, but that there is an element of symmetry needed between nuclear powers in order to get nuclear deterrence. And it's a question of how a nuclear conflict might play out. In the Iran-Israel conflict, we have a much more asymmetric situation with Iran not being a nuclear power and therefore being at this place. Its conventional capabilities were ultimately not able to deter action.
If the Trump administration were following your proposed strategy in the recent Iran crisis, what would we expect to see happen in contrast to what's actually happened?
I'm not sure the Trump administration could necessarily follow our strategy here, right? Our strategy is designed to deter nuclear threats. And again, Iran did not have a nuclear weapon, although there's been some different messages from members of the Trump administration over whether Iran had made a decision to acquire a nuclear weapon. And it seems like probably the intelligence was that no such decision had actually been made. So the Trump administration is engaging in a preemptive strike against a future potential nuclear adversary, not a nuclear power. What I think is a bit unfortunate about the Trump administration's decisions is that we would hope that members of the Trump administration would be deterred by the Iranian military. It is a powerful conventional military, and the costs of a large-scale conventional conflict between Iran and Israeli forces, or Iran and Israeli and American forces, are massive. This is not a war that anyone can truly win. And the result of that should be that we exercise quite a bit of caution in making decisions that could start that kind of conflict. This is not what we've seen from the Trump administration. Their calculus was different, maybe much more concerned about what a nuclear-capable Iran might do in the region. But we have ended up in a situation where the Trump administration did not appear to be deterred by Iran's conventional military capabilities and has made a decision that risks a much broader conflict with potentially massive destructive capabilities for the region. So we are in a very dangerous moment in time.
Well, just before we finish, I wanted to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any other work from yourself or any other upcoming projects you have that you think our listeners might find to be of interest.
One argument that we make in the paper, which we didn't have the chance to talk too much about today, is how the political environments in the different players really matter. So I mentioned earlier, you know, the US and China have these differing views of nuclear weapons. And states have different thresholds for when they might decide to pull the trigger on nuclear weapons. And all of this speaks to how these domestic environments play out. In particular, we point to the role of growing partisanship and polarization in the United States as a potential complicator for the ability of the United States to not only engage in arms control, but also signal effectively to its allies and partners around the region. One of the things that I'm working on now at the United States Center is a series of papers that look at the effects of the polarized U.S. environment on its commitments around the world. So keep an eye out for new research coming out of the U.S. Center on that topic.
That's great. Well, listeners should definitely keep an eye out for that. It just remains for me to say, Professor Lauren Sukin, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thank you very much, Chris. It was a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Lauren Sukin is an assistant professor in LSE's Department of International Relations and a center affiliate at the LSE Phelan U.S. Center. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Lauren Sukin for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Luke Digweed. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at lse_us. and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It really helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.